This is edition number 2007 of The Mardler, recorded in Aylsham on Friday, the 6th of March, 2026. Hello, you are listening to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper for North Norfolk. Today we bring you the week's news and views from the North Norfolk News of Thursday, the 5th of March, 2026. My name is Kate Harris, and my fellow readers are
Merlin Waterson,
Hannah Steff,
and Imogen Waterson.
On the notice board today, this week the sun will rise around 25 minutes past 6 and will set at about 10 to 6.
The magazine supplement will follow a little later in the programme and includes a whale skeleton, colloquial poetry, noisy joints and some books.
But we begin with the main news items, which include improvements to Mawston Quay, the need for new schools in Norfolk, the void in Sheringham Promenade and the wrong sort of windows in Holt. Let's start with those lead stories.
The National Trust has abandoned its previous vision for Mawston Quay, which sparked anger along the coast, and now proposes to knock down its toilet block and replace it with a more modern one. It said it had reviewed the hundreds of objections received before it pulled its previous application last May and sought to address many of the concerns raised with its new plans. It added it did not intend to change the way it operates the site, and the new development was aimed at improving the visitor experience and not to attract more visitors to the beauty spot between Wells and Sheringham. A planning statement lodged with the new proposals says the existing toilets, which were installed in 2019 to replace brick-built former council loos behind them, were no longer sufficient for the demand from visitors. Mawston Quay is under ever-increasing visitor footfall pressure due to several factors, including the increase in the popularity of seal trips to Blakeney Point and the increase in participation of water-based recreation within Blakeney Harbour, it adds. We do not, however, have enough toilet capacity, especially for ladies, to cope with the large number of visitors arriving in short periods of time prior to boat trips. Furthermore, the increased use of the Coastliner bus service, which has a bus stop by the main entrance to the car park, and the increase in popularity of the Norfolk Coast Path that passes directly through the car park all add to the increasing demand and expectation for visitor facilities. A public consultation meeting was staged at the site in September before the plans were finalised. The National Trust said 80 people attended. Feedback was positive and attendees expressed support for the design and scale of the proposed building. New drainage is also set to be installed to prevent puddles forming in the car park, which will be resurfaced. The lookout building nearby, which houses a welcome centre and cafe, will remain unchanged. Anger erupted along the coast after the National Trust launched its previous bid to redevelop the quayside in 2024. Hundreds of locals and visitors objected to the plans, which included a new visitor centre with offices and replacement toilets.
More than 20 new schools, at a cost of almost £400 million, will be needed in Norfolk to cope with families moving into thousands of planned new homes in the county. The need for new schools and extensions to existing ones in dozens of towns and villages is set out in a new Norfolk County Council report. Areas such as Rackheath, Attleborough, Thetford, East Norwich, West Winch, and Beeston Park, where tens of thousands of new homes are planned, will need new facilities to cope with the influx of families with children, according to the report. The Council's School Sufficiency Plan outlines need for the 3 years from 2026 and 2029, but also includes details of where new schools may be needed over the next 25 years. The overall cost of all the new places which will be needed is £389 million. The costs of the new schools will be covered by contributions from the developers of new housing and the Department for Education. Yet the need for new sites also comes at a time when some of the county's schools face uncertain futures because of declining birth rates. Primary school pupil numbers have dropped from a peak of 65,102 children in 2018-19 to 59,830 in the current year, a drop of 8%. With budgets so closely linked to pupil numbers, that is putting pressure on some schools to remain sustainable. Council education officials have previously warned that that might lead to some schools closing or merging or becoming part of a larger academy trust. Discussions have already taken place in some areas of the county. Penny Carpenter, the council's cabinet member for school services, said, "This report shows the significant challenges we face in making sure we have school places in the right areas to support children and families. The birth rate is falling, and this is putting significant pressure on some schools, whilst others are oversubscribed because of parental choice or housing growth. Our officers are working very closely with education leaders to help them plan for the future, while at the same time working with district councils and developers to ensure we have enough school places in areas of growth. This report is very much based on what we know now and anticipates what we need to invest in the next decade and beyond. The plan will be discussed when County Hall's Conservative-controlled cabinet meets this week."
The potential cause of a large void which has closed the promenade for more than a month has been explained by an engineer. A stretch of walkway in Sheringham was closed to the public by North Norfolk District Council on January the 14th after the void was first discovered. Initial investigations described the hole on the eastern end of the beach as large enough to accommodate a transit van, and work began to fill it last week. Brian Farrow, coastal engineer at the council, has taken to the camera to explain what may cause such a large sinkhole and the process of the investigation. He said the seawall was built around the 1920s and founded on chalk, a soluble material which the sea can cut through. And behind it, there is sand and gravel, which are then easily washed away once the water cuts through the underside of the wall. We drilled some small holes in the slab and dropped a half-inch rod in. The rods then disappeared, so we knew we had a big sinkhole. We then cut 12-inch holes in it so we could see much better. Surprise, surprise, we found a massive hole. Since the work began last week, more than 200 square metres of concrete has been poured into the void. And as the project continues, the council has advised the public to stay clear of the area and do not cross through the safety barriers demarking the site. The progress will be monitored over the coming weeks, but it is still unclear at this stage when the work is likely to be completed, nor when the section will be reopening to the public. So far, it is believed to be an isolated incident, and there are no other ongoing investigations into similar incidents. However, the council has said that the promenade in Sheringham is routinely monitored alongside other infrastructure around the coastline.
An unsuspecting couple have wound up at the centre of a planning row that risks opening up a can of worms in an upmarket town. Gina Ward and her husband replaced their draughty, ageing timber windows with new A-rated, energy-efficient double glazing at their flat in Holt in a bid to cut bills and keep them warm. But unfortunately for the couple, they were completely unaware their home at the Beaches, a group of retirement flats within a large Georgian house, was a listed building with strict rules on what can be changed. The name of the property had been changed 35 years ago from the Shrublands, and Historic England had not updated its list of listed buildings to reflect its new title, meaning the couple, who were previously in the property and construction business, had not realised it had the conservation status. They only discovered the issue after North Norfolk District Council's enforcement officers complained they had broken the rules by replacing the traditional timber frames with modern plastic windows. Mrs. Ward said neither her conveyancing solicitor nor the estate agent had any knowledge it was a Grade 2 listed building either. The couple have now been told by councillors the windows are not permitted to stay, meaning they may be forced to remove them. But the decision may have wider implications for the other residents at the Beaches, who have also changed windows in their flats. Officials warned the decision would open up a can of worms in the town and district by setting a precedent. The large property in Station Road is characteristic of the grand Georgian homes that are common in Holt. It has been listed for decades, but the property was originally known as the Shrublands. At a recent development committee meeting, a representative from Holt Town Council, Maggie Pryor, urged North Norfolk District Council to be sympathetic towards the ward's plight. She said, "The intention here was never to cause harm, only to resolve a serious comfort and safety issue. The Beaches is already surrounded by a significant number of modern replacement windows installed over many years across several flats. It seems disproportionate to us to single out this one resident for enforcement when the visual impact of their windows is very little and in some cases less noticeable than others already in place." Mrs. Ward said her solicitors have admitted liability for failing to identify the fact the Beaches is a listed building and said they replaced the windows as they had become completely rotten. She provided 45 photographs to the council of other buildings in the conservation area of Holt Town Centre, some of which are listed, that also had modern windows installed. Mrs. Ward added, "I really feel I am being used as a test case because Pandora's box has had the lid ripped off." Having been the director of a company managing a listed building near Norwich St Andrew Park, she added, "I am well aware of listed buildings and conservation." Her husband was unable to attend the meeting after recently suffering a stroke, which Mrs. Ward believes was brought on in part due to the stress of the planning row. As the meeting continued, a planning officer said he had brought the application to the committee because it is such a can of worms in terms of the implications of this decision for whatever action we take, not only in Holt, but in the whole of the district. He added, "If we were to allow this, then people in other listed buildings may also put plastic windows in and apply for permission afterwards. We've got more than 2,000 listed buildings, and we need to make sure we're not sort of setting ourselves on a course that creates similar again." When it came to the vote, councillors acknowledged they were between a rock and a hard place. In fact, the predicament proved too much for the majority of councillors, with 5 out of the 11 members choosing to abstain and not vote either way. One councillor voted against. It meant that ultimately the application was rejected despite less than half of the councillors voting to do so. Ms. Ward has signalled the couple will review their next steps following further conversations with enforcement officers.
A potential opening date for Norfolk Town's new banking hub has been revealed. The North Walsham Banking Hub is expected to open on March the 13th in the former Barclays building. Hubs allow people to withdraw and deposit cash, deposit cheques, pay utility bills and check account balances. And registered businesses will be able to collect change. It will host a community banking service where customers can talk to their own bank. Lucy Shires, District and County Councillor for the town, announced the news in a post on social media. She said, "Access to everyday financial services is essential for market towns like ours, particularly for older residents, small traders, and those who rely on cash. After years of seeing bank branches disappear, it's good to see a new model stepping in to keep services local. Please note, this is the anticipated opening date and, as with any new service launch, this could change." It comes after the new banking hub opened in Cromer with North Norfolk MP Stefan Equaroni cutting the ribbon.
A redundant barn on the North Norfolk coast is set for a new lease of life. Mr and Mrs Thirst have submitted a proposal to North Norfolk District Council, NNDC, to convert the building on their property off Haysborough Road in East Ruston into a new therapy room. This would offer services such as counselling, holistic therapy, massage or well-being coaching by a qualified practitioner on an appointment-only basis if it is approved. The plans would see the former stables and pigsties transformed into two therapy and treatment rooms, a waiting area, a toilet and a kitchenette. The statement added, "This application proposes a sensitive and sustainable conversion of a redundant farm building to provide a valuable local therapy service, supporting both rural economic activity and community well-being. Access to the site will be from Haysborough Road, and parking for two or three vehicles will be provided on existing hard standing." Documents said, "The site is safe and accessible from the highway and does not require new access infrastructure."
Plans have emerged for new homes at a Norfolk farm. Developers have applied for planning permission from North Norfolk District Council to convert four barns into seven homes in Skeighton, a village between Aylsham and North Walsham. The proposal includes turning one of the barns at Beach Farm in Felmingham Road into three-storey houses and the three smaller buildings into four single-storey properties. A planning statement said that the majority of the barns within the yard are still used for general agricultural purposes, including the storage of machinery. However, some of the buildings are redundant following the end of pig farming at the site. The houses would all have two car parking spaces and gardens each if it is approved. The council will make a decision on the application, which was submitted by R.W. Randell and Son, in due course.
A new off-grid holiday cabin offering a unique glamping retreat has been earmarked for a Norfolk town. Plans have been put forward by Remy Coggle for the development north of Mill Road in Reefham. The cabin would provide one double bedroom, as well as a lounge, a kitchen diner, and a shower room. The proposal also includes the demolition and removal of the existing agricultural buildings and structures on the site. The cabin is designed to offer a unique glamping retreat stay, as well as an escape from the pace of modern town-city life. In a planning statement, it was said that the development would provide short-stay holiday accommodation for visitors. The statement added that there is site-specific demand for the proposed cabin and highlighted its close proximity to tourist attractions, including Whitwell and Reefham railway station. It was also mentioned that the proposal would diversify and enhance the tourism offer in the area and create opportunities for local business.
Our next few news stories include a new development in the Sheringham bus shelter saga, problems with food waste collection in North Norfolk, Cromer crime figures, and an awful lot of chickens near Aylsham.
The long-running Sheringham bus shelter saga has seen a new group formed, which hopes to end division in the town. Tensions have been inflamed after Sheringham Town Council agreed to a revised Norfolk County Council transport hub scheme, which cuts the 1950s structure on station approach in half. This compromise design emerged after protesters successfully fought to save the bus shelter from being completely demolished by the County Council in December. And while some people in the town are keen to see the works completed, others have been left feeling betrayed and argued that the new designs completely changed the character of the shelter. But now a new group has been launched calling to reset and strengthen the plans for the site with a constructive partnership before work begins this autumn. The Sheringham Travel and Safety Partnership has called for an open steering group to be set up with representatives from the Town Council, North Norfolk District Council, Norfolk County Council, transport operators and other stakeholders. This is to deliver an Ottendorf Green transport hub project, which includes improved pedestrian and road safety, the retention of the bus shelter, and better bus infrastructure and accessibility. District Councillor Liz Withington, who is involved in the partnership, said, "This is a constructive moment to reset. With works not expected to commence until autumn 2026, we now have a genuine opportunity to bring partners together and develop a fully integrated solution. Safety, accessibility, heritage and sustainable transport should complement one another. A collaborative steering group is the sensible next step to rebuild confidence and deliver a scheme that truly works for Sheringham." The group has stressed that it does not plan to reoccupy or interfere in the site and said this is a crucial opportunity to move away from division and towards positive, evidence-based solutions. It comes after the Town Council boarded up the shelter, after it was made aware of possible attempts to interfere with works taking place on site. It said this measure is necessary to allow it to progress with the project without further delay. The Town Council agreed to support the revised scheme for Norfolk County Council's NCC Ottendorf Green revamp at a meeting on February the 17th, and work on the site is set to start this autumn.
A second Norfolk council has said it will miss a government deadline to begin collecting food waste. North Norfolk District Council officials have said it will not be able to begin offering the service until early 2027 due to issues receiving vehicles to collect the waste. Great Yarmouth Borough Council has already admitted it will be unable to meet the government-set deadline of April 2026. At a recent council meeting, Callum Ringer, NNDC Cabinet Member for Waste, said, "In March last year, this council voted to proceed with allocating funds for a fleet of vehicles to enable a rollout of domestic food waste collections, a service that will soon become a statutory responsibility for all local councils. Throughout this process, we've engaged constructively with the Department for Environment and Rural Affairs about the challenges we anticipated. One of the risks we identified early on was a rush to market, with many authorities across the country placing fleet orders simultaneously. Our original time frame would have seen us take delivery of vehicles in late summer, with a view to rolling out a service in the autumn. Unfortunately, but somewhat predictably, we have now been informed of delays to that delivery. We're not alone in that, and a number of our neighbouring authorities are facing similar delays. Great Yarmouth Borough Council has also said it will not be able to provide food waste collections by April. Manufacturers for the new vehicles have told the authority it could be late 2027 by the time it receives a fleet of food waste trucks. South Norfolk Council and Breckland Council, the two other Norfolk authorities set to introduce the food waste collections, have not said when they will begin the service yet. The remaining district councils already provide such collections.
New figures have revealed the streets with the highest number of recorded crime in Cromer last year and how offences correlate to the tourist season. An analysis of data from police.uk has shown that 816 individual crimes were reported in the North Norfolk town in 2025. Violent crime, which includes harassment, assault and sexual offences, was recorded the most at 44%, followed by antisocial behaviour at 14% and criminal damage and arson at 10%. It was also found that crime was 47% higher during the summer months compared to winter. August and September recorded the joint highest monthly totals at 88 crimes each, while December had the lowest of 50 crimes. Central Road, High Street and Woodcock Road were found to be the streets with the most recorded crimes in the town at 24 each. In Central Road, shoplifting dominated as the most common offence, whereas violent crime and criminal damage were reported the most in the High Street and Woodcock Road. Cromer Road, which links the town to surrounding villages, followed at 21 crimes, where drug offences are notably higher here at 19% than on any other top 10 street. Long Lane and Cabell Road both had 18 incidents reported, with violent crime recorded the most alongside public order and antisocial behaviour offences. Jetty Street, which is one of the oldest streets in Cromer and has a rich history tied to the town's fishing heritage, also makes the list, but with antisocial behaviour as the leading crime type. Hamilton Road and the residential streets Hans Place and Vicarage Road are the last three, with burglary, crime damage and violent crime all reported across the year. Other location types such as supermarkets, petrol stations and parking areas were excluded because they do not correspond to specific name streets, despite their high numbers. Police also urged caution when interpreting the data. Crime locations on police.uk are approximate, snapped to the nearest predefined map point. Overall, the town had an annual crime rate of 96.7 per 1,000 residents, which is deemed low in comparison to others across the country.
A major chicken farm could be built on the edge of a Norfolk town as a family-run farming business plans to diversify. E.F. Harold, which farms around Aylsham, hopes to build four poultry houses on land off Alton Street in Cawston to produce around 1.36 million chickens a year. The company has submitted plans to Broadland Council, which also includes new feed bins, service buildings, access improvements and drainage infrastructure at the site of Docking Farm. In the planning papers, It said this bid represents a strategic investment to secure the future of the farming business, which has been operating in Norfolk for more than 50 years. While the company has specialised in growing a range of crops, such as potatoes, wheat, sugar beet and maize, the document said in recent years the profitability of traditional arable farming has come under increasing pressure. So, it is looking to diversify and move into poultry production, which is supported by strong customer demand and stable market returns to help with the long-term sustainability of the business. The four buildings are set to house around 45,000 broiler chickens each, amounting to 180,000 birds per production cycle. It is then hoped that the development will operate with approximately 7.6 flocks per year, producing an estimated 1.36 million birds annually. The documents added that the manure will be removed from the site and transported directly to Thetford Power Station, where it will be used as a renewable energy source. It is also said that the farm will generate only a modest number of vehicle movements, with an average of 2 to 3 HGV visits per day, and vehicle routing to be managed to ensure that HGVs use the B1149 rather than minor local roads. To view or comment on the proposal, search 2026/0314 on the Broadland Council planning portal.
A school has been praised for supporting children who care for family members. All Saints School in Lessingham has been recognised for its work with a prestigious award after winning the Young Carers in Schools Award for its efforts to identify and support young carers. These are children under 18 who care for a family member who could not cope without their help due to illness, disability, mental health issues or addiction. Samantha Dangerfield, head teacher, said, "We're absolutely thrilled to have received the Young Carers in Schools Award. It means a great deal to us because it recognises the work we do every day to support all of our students, including those who have caring responsibilities at home. This award belongs to our whole school community, and we'll continue working hard to make sure every young carer here feels valued and able to succeed." All Saints offers regular support to young carers through weekly group sessions, homework help, and drop-in opportunities with a dedicated staff member. Students also take part in specially organised school trips. Anastasia, aged 12, said, "It helps me to talk about how I am feeling. I know that someone is there to help. I can also look after my friends if they are stressed or upset." Molly, aged 14, said, "I like how I know it's coming, so I know I'll get a small break from lessons. Also, if I'm worried about something, I can just stay behind and ask, rather than go out of my way, which I struggle with sometimes." Gemma Montgomery, well-being mentor and lead for young carers at the school, said, "I feel incredibly proud that our school has achieved the Young Carers in School Award. The award is part of the Young Carers in School programme, run by the Children's Society and the Carers Trust. The scheme provides tools and guidance to help schools identify and support young carers. Research from Carers Trust shows 40% of young carers feel unsupported in balancing their education and caring responsibilities."
Three bookshops in Norfolk have reached the final of a prestigious award. The finalists have been revealed for the Independent Bookshop of the Year category at the British Book Awards 2026. For the East of England category, The Book Hive in Norwich, the Holt Bookshop, and Norfolk Children's Book Centre in Albury have been nominated once again. The Holt Bookshop and Norfolk Children's Book Centre were in the running in 2025, but just missed out as Malden Books in Essex took the glory. The Book Hive was a finalist in 2024 and has won the award in 2018 and 2020. Its owner, Henry Late, was named East Anglian Book Award's Exceptional Contribution winner in 2024. Malden Books and Red Lion Books in Colchester are also competing in the East of England category. The regional winners of the Independent Bookshop of the Year Award, now in its 17th year, will be announced on May the 10th, while the overall winner will be revealed during the British Book Awards ceremony at Grosvenor House, London, on May the 11th.
A restaurant that has brought a string of famous faces to the Norfolk coast has had a revamp. Since it launched in the summer of 2024, the White Horse in East Runton has gone from strength to strength. It has even welcomed celebrity guests such as Katie Price, Mark Wright and Ollie Mears for dinner. The venue has now been given a new look, with a series of cherry blossom designs installed across the ceiling. We wanted to create an environment that feels special but still welcoming, the restaurant's owner Carl Stairs said. The blossom canopy has completely changed the atmosphere in the restaurant and given it a real sense of occasion for diners. He added that early feedback from customers had been positive, with many praising the design and relaxed atmosphere. The venue is well known for its range of food and cocktails. A series of events and seasonal menu launches have been planned throughout the year.
A Norfolk mobility shop wants to expand due to fears of its frontage being blocked by a neighbouring business. Holt Mobility hopes to build an extension on its showroom off Weybourne Road in Bodham to increase the size of its sales area. In plans submitted to North Norfolk District Council, the business said the bid has been partly prompted by the recent approval granted to their neighbour, Crayford and Abbs. Crayford and Abbs, a car dealership on the same site, was given planning permission for an extension on their building towards the end of last year. However, Holt Mobility had concerns their shop frontage would be concealed by the neighbour's extension, so it has put an exact replica of the application extending to the same position and following the same architectural form, which maintains the desired visibility of the store. A planning statement said, "This application is vital for the ongoing viability of this much-respected local business. To view or comment on the plans, search PF26-0336 on the NNDC planning portal." You are listening to edition number 2007 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday the 6th of March 2026. Still to come, there are items about renewable energy and a brave Coast Guard and, of course, the Mardler magazine supplement. But before all of that, we have two obituaries.
Henry Thomas Barge, known as Harry, passed away peacefully on February the 21st, 2026, aged 90. Dearly loved husband of Pamela, deceased, father of Amanda, Alan, deceased, and Richard, grandfather of Aaron and Sophie, and brother to Kenneth. The funeral service will take place at Cromer Crematorium on Friday, March the 13th, at 11 a.m. Family flowers only, please. All inquiries to Fox's Funeral Services, telephone number 01263 512427.
Julia Elizabeth Bond, formerly Smith and Stone, of Sheringham. Mum to Susanna and Samantha, Nana to Joshua, Elliot and Daniel. Former respected nursing sister at Addenbrookes and Evelyn Hospitals, Cambridge. Passed away peacefully at the age of 84 on February the 16th, 2026. Her final goodbye will take place at St Peter's Church, Sheringham, Tuesday, March the 17th. Close friends and family, no donations, but spring flowers are very welcome, to be delivered in advance to Blythe and Sons Funeral Directors, 4 Creamer Street, Sheringham.
And now some local events. On Sunday the 8th of March, you can take a winter boat trip on Hickling Broad. Departures at 10:30 a.m. and 1:30 p.m. with a cost of £19.02. Discover Hickling's amazing winter wildlife on a trip into the heart of the Broad. Booking is essential. Contact 01603 625 540. And on Wednesday the 11th of March, the Loddon Horticultural Society will host a talk by Sarah Hammond on the subject of peonies, starting at 7:30 p.m. at Jubilee Hall, George Lane, Loddon, and the cost is £2. Contact 01502 710 024. And on Friday the 13th of March, folk musicians Christina Alden and Alex Patterson perform nature-inspired songs with enchanting vocal, fiddle, guitar and banjo, starting at 7 p.m. at the Clay and Salt House Visitor Centre, Coast Road, Clay Next the Sea, and the cost is £17.43. Contact 01603 625 540. We turn now to this week's Mardler magazine supplement, where we hear the story of the Langness Whale, listen to the work of an English poet, receive some professional joint advice, and make our monthly visit to Book Corner.
Let's begin with Catherine Nicol as she tells the story of the Langness Whale. This article was published on the BBC News website on the 17th of August 2025. A century ago, the appearance of a stranded sei whale on the shore at Langness caused shock and fascination among people on the Isle of Man. Sei whales are the third largest whale species after blue whales and fin whales. Dark in colour with a white underbelly, they have long, sleek bodies that can grow up to 64 foot long, allowing them to travel at speeds of up to 34 miles an hour. Usually found alone or in small groups, they are baleen whales, which consume about 2,000 pounds of plankton each day, diving for up to 20 minutes at a time to feed. Listed as endangered, the marine mammals are usually seen in deeper waters, away from the coast. Mammoth efforts were needed to move the 48-foot carcass in a mission that involved ropes, chains, trailers, steam traction engines, and even a tugboat. Its skeleton remains the largest single artifact held in the Manx Museum's national collections. But the whale's arrival on Manx shores marked only the start of a final journey that would last a decade and capture the imagination of the island. The female sei whale became stranded in a gully at Langness on the southern coast of the island in the summer of 1925. Such was the spectacle that crowds of people, including families with children, streamed down to the shore to see the creature. Curator of Natural History for Manx National Heritage, Laura McCoy, explained, "It was at a time when natural history and antiquarian societies were very prominent. Things like whale skeletons were seen as a very prestigious thing to have," she said. "And so when this opportunity came about, the museum was like, we want that skeleton." But taking it into the collections of the newly opened Manx Museum was not as simple as just staking a claim on it, as all cetaceans are the property of the British Crown. Once permission was secured for the whale to be taken locally, something had to be done to move the rotting carcass, which was by now becoming a public nuisance. Without the powerful portable machinery of the modern age, a series of manoeuvres was needed to move the whale. That involved wrapping it in chains to drag it back out to sea, where it was refloated and pulled around the coast to Derby Haven by a tugboat. Once there, it was hauled ashore onto large trailers using ropes and chains to allow it to be transported to an abattoir in Douglas to be defleshed. Such was the putrid smell of decay that, it is said, police at the head of the cavalcade warned people along the route to shut their windows as it passed by. After the bulk of the flesh was removed, the bones were buried for 4 years to finish the defleshing. "A common way to prepare whale skeletons, even to this day, is to bury them," Ms. McCoy said. "That allows all the little creatures to get into the bones. Then you dig out your nice skeleton that is hopefully very dry and clean and not smelly." With that process taking about 4 years, the task remained of finding somewhere appropriate in the Manx Museum to house the huge specimen. Following a fundraising effort, the Langness whale found a home in the newly created Edward Forms Gallery, named in honour of the notable Manx botanist. Ms. McCoy said, "While a skeletonised whale would have been a little lighter once the flesh had been removed, it would still have been incredibly heavy, with the skull alone weighing more than a ton. The enormity of the task of mounting the creature meant it was a fairly prolonged project, which the records had shown had involved barrels of papier-mâché and steel," she said. Once in situ, the skeleton remained in position for the next 7 decades. That was until a revamp of part of the museum saw the opening of a new natural history gallery in 2005, leading to another epic task of moving the bones, this time with the help of modern techniques. The Langness whale remains on display in the Natural History Gallery of the Manx Museum to this day.
For our next article, we call upon Edward Thomas, a British writer of English poetry and prose. Born in Lambeth in 1878, he only started writing poetry at the age of 36, but by that time he had already been a prolific critic, biographer, nature writer and travel writer for 2 decades. At 39 years of age, he was killed in action during the Battle of Arras in 1917, soon after he had arrived at the front. His poetry lives on, written in a colloquial style and frequently featuring the English countryside. Today we present 2 of his poems. The first, Aspens, was written in 1915 against the backdrop of the Great War. Thomas identifies in the tree's continuous movement a metaphor for human endeavour. Like the aspen poplars, we have no choice but to go on. All day and night, save winter, every weather, above the inn, the smithy and the shop, the aspens at the crossroads talk together of rain, until their last leaves fall from the top. Out of the blacksmith's cavern comes the ringing of hammer, shoe and anvil. Out of the inn, the clink, the hum, the roar, the random singing, the sounds that for these 50 years have been. The whisper of the aspens is not drowned. An over lightless pane and footless road, empty as sky, with every other sound not ceasing, calls their ghosts from their abode. A silent smithy, a silent inn, nor fails in the bare moonlight or the thick furred gloom, in tempest or the night of nightingales, to turn the crossroads to a ghostly room. And it would be the same where no house near. Of all sorts of weather, men and times, aspens must shake their leaves, and men may hear, but need not listen, more than to my rhymes. Whatever wind blows, while they and I have leaves, we cannot other than an aspen be, that ceaselessly, unreasonably grieves, or so men think who like a different tree. Our second Thomas poem is called Adelstrop. Written shortly before his death with the chaos of war around him, it is his most familiar poem. In it he recalls the serenity of a railway station in an English country village in the months immediately before the outbreak of war in 1914. Yes, I remember Adelstrop. The name, because one afternoon of heat, the express train drew up there unwontedly. It was late June. The steam hissed. Someone cleared his throat. No one left, and no one came on the bare platform. What I saw was Adelstrop, only the name. And willows, willow herb and grass and meadowsweet and haycocks dry, no whit less still and lonely fair than the high cloudlets in the sky. And for that minute a blackbird sang close by, and round him, mistier, farther and farther, all the birds of Oxfordshire and Gloucestershire.
For our next article, we hear from Dr. Clodagh Toomey, Associate Professor at the University of Limerick, as she explains that we shouldn't worry if our joints crack, pop or crunch. This item was published on the website theconversation.com on the 3rd of February 2026. Many of us have noisy joints. Knees crack on the stairs, necks pop when we stretch, and knuckles seem to crack almost on demand. These sounds can be startling and are often blamed on ageing, damage, or the looming threat of arthritis. As a physiotherapist and researcher of chronic joint pain, I am frequently asked whether joint noises are something to worry about. The reassuring answer is that, in most cases, they are not. The familiar crack from knuckles, backs, or necks is usually caused by a process called cavitation. Joints are surrounded by a capsule filled with synovial fluid, a thick lubricant that contains dissolved gases such as oxygen, nitrogen, and carbon dioxide. When a joint is stretched beyond its usual range, pressure inside the capsule drops. A gas bubble forms and collapses, producing the popping sound. Other noises are different. Snapping sounds often come from tendons moving over bony structures. Grinding, crunching or creaking noises, known as crepitus, are particularly common in the knees. These are thought to arise from movement between cartilage and bone surfaces and often felt as well as heard. Knees are especially prone to crepitus because of how they work. The kneecap sits in a groove at the front of the thigh bone and is guided by muscle above and below it. If those muscles pull unevenly because of strength imbalances, tightness, or foot and hip mechanics, the kneecap can track slightly off centre. This can increase the crunching or grinding sensation. Noise on its own is rarely a problem. What matters clinically is whether it comes with other symptoms. Pain, swelling, locking of the joint, or a noticeable reduction in function are the things that warrant further assessment. Overall, there is no convincing evidence that cracking joints causes damage to joint structures, strength, or long-term joint health. The audible pop itself can provide a calming, satisfying sensation, which may lead to developing that habitual self-soothing mechanism for tension that annoys your family members and friends. People who have joint conditions, such as knee osteoarthritis, and have noisy joints tend to report slightly more pain and reduced function compared to people with osteoarthritis and no crepitus. It may be reassuring to know that there is no difference in tests like walking speed or muscle strength between groups, pointing to a potential psychological impact of noisy knees. Crucially, noise alone is not a reason to stop being active. Some people reduce their physical activity because they fear they are wearing out their joints. In fact, the opposite is true. Movement is essential for joint health. Cartilage relies on regular compression and release to receive nutrients, as it has very limited blood supply. Exercise is a cornerstone of joint health and is recommended as the first treatment to try in national and international clinical guidelines for conditions such as osteoarthritis. Consistency matters more than the specific type of exercise. The best exercise is the one that will keep you going. There is no evidence that supplements such as collagen or fish oils reduce joint noise. Large studies show limited effects on pain and function at a population level, although some people report benefits. These supplements are generally safe, but if they do not help, they are unlikely to be worth the cost. Joint noises are usually harmless. They are worth assessing if they are accompanied by pain, swelling, locking, or reduced function, or if they are limiting your confidence to move. Staying active is one of the best things you can do for your joints, whether they crack, pop, crunch, or stay silent.
For our last item, we visit Book Corner, where we follow the poetic theme introduced by Merlin. When we were at school, many of us learned about the famous poets and even learned poems by heart to recite in class. Some of us can remember those words to this day. Poetry uses creative, rhythmic, and imaginative language to evoke emotions or ideas. It's often arranged in lines, always has a rhythm, and words may even rhyme. With so many poets to choose from, it's difficult to know which ones to highlight. A quick look at Wikipedia, the online encyclopedia, lists thousands of internationally notable poets from across the centuries. Among the earliest recorded poems were the Iliad and the Odyssey, written by the Greek poet Homer in the 5th century BC. Or perhaps we could choose to read those written by the most famous English poets, such as William Shakespeare, William Wordsworth, Lord Byron, and John Keats. So, here's a poetry book to get you started. 100 Poets, a Little Anthology by John Carey. This anthology of verse is based on a simple principle. Select the 100 greatest poets from across the centuries and then choose their finest poems. Ranging from Homer and Sappho to Donne and Milton, Plath and Angelou, this is a delightful and accessible introduction to the very best that poetry can offer. Familiar favourites are nestled along marvellous new discoveries, all woven together with an expert commentary. Of course, There is an endless choice of books about individual poets, those living in a particular era or themed around a topic. Here's another anthology you might like to read. Six Poets, From Hardy to Larkin, edited by Alan Bennett. This personal collection includes more than 70 poems by six well-loved poets from the 20th century. Alan Bennett writes about the poets and their verse in his customary conversational style, through anecdote, shrewd appraisal, and spare but telling biographical detail. Ranging from hidden treasures to famous poems, this is a collection for the beginner and the expert alike. Next, we have a collection of poems to make you smile. Laughter Lines by Des O'Connor. This much-loved entertainment legend has broadcast to millions and performed to packed theatres around the world, but he never lost touch with the simple joys and woes of everyday life. In this collection of comic verse, Des brings his irrepressible humour and mischievous delight to subjects ranging from sat-nav nightmares to the perils of sorting the recycling, from the recipe for a happy love life to surviving children's parties. And finally, we will leave you to ponder the emergence of a one-letter poems. This poem, by Canadian avant-garde artist J.W. Curry, is the lowercase letter I. The whole work is comprised of a black rectangle standing upright on its short side with the author's thumbprint above to form a dot. A nice, easy one to learn by heart. If you are tempted to listen to some poetry books, you can borrow or request a huge selection from your favourite audio library, such as Calibre, RNIB, or Norfolk County Libraries. You can even listen to them on the internet or an Alexa smart speaker.
And those items conclude this week's magazine supplement. Our thanks go to the authors of these articles for their contributions.
Returning to the news, our penultimate selection of articles include new funding for the community groups, plans for an anaerobic digester at former RAF Alton, a Thursford bed and breakfast appearing on television, and new life for the Felmingham Railway Station.
New funding is helping community groups reach those who need them most. Half a dozen organisations in North Norfolk have been awarded financial support from the Randall Foundation through the Norfolk Community Foundation, part of a wider package for 12 projects across the county. The funding is designed to boost education and healthcare for disadvantaged groups, combat mental ill health, and reduce poverty. Two groups already receiving support are the Ludham Village Car Scheme and Wells Nelson Club. Ken Grapes, joint chairman of Ludham Village Car Scheme, said, "We are extremely grateful to the Randall Foundation for its generous grant, which will enable this valuable village facility to continue looking after Ludham." The volunteer-led scheme uses personal vehicles to take residents to medical appointments, completing around 400 journeys a year. For older residents, the scheme is often the only way to reach routine care. One resident said, "My family cannot always take me to the chiropodist, but I can call a car, so I get the treatment that keeps me walking." Running the scheme costs between £800 and £1,000 annually. The Wells Nelson Club, which celebrated its 50th birthday at the start of last year, also relies on transport to keep older residents connected and active. Sandra, a club volunteer, said, "We do lots of different things at the club, from interesting speakers to games afternoons and days out. If we did not use the Age Concern minibus, many of our members would not be able to get to the meetings." The full cost of transport this year is being covered by the Randall Foundation. Laura Wigby, Director of Programmes at Norfolk Community Foundation, said, "We know what incredible community activity can grow from modest amounts of funding, and we were delighted to be able to help the Randall Foundation reach communities working hard to support one another."
A new renewable energy facility may be built on a former RAF airfield. Plans have emerged for an anaerobic digestion AD plant on part of the former RAF Olton airfield near Aylsham. Bluestone Biogas has submitted the proposal to Broadland Council to build the facility on land off the street to convert crops like maize into a renewable energy source and fertiliser. In the planning documents, it said the crops fueling the plant would be sourced within a 15-mile radius of the site, dependent on rotations and availability of supply. Once the feed is broken down, it'll produce biogas, methane, which can be pumped directly into the gas network, and biofertilizer to help new crops grow. The company held a public consultation about the proposal, where the local community raised a number of concerns, with the main one being additional traffic. It has been predicted that during the peak times of harvest in July, there may be 109 daily HGV trips, which will then decrease to around 28 per day outside harvest time. These will be restricted to 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. during normal operations, and from 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. during harvest. In response to the concerns, the developer suggested a new route south of the site to join the B1149 so the traffic would avoid using the street. However, Norfolk County Council and Highways considered the street to be the preferred option, so instead the developer has proposed restrictions on site traffic. Odour fears were also raised, but Bluestone has confirmed, as no waste products will be used, there is no odour associated with the raw materials and very little with the production process. Biofertiliser will then be kept in fully covered and sealed storage before it is transported off the site. Bluestone Biogas is a wholly owned subsidiary of Future Biogas, one of the largest and most experienced operators of biogas plants in the UK. The site at RAF Olton, which was built during the Second World War and was used to house heavy bombers, spans 46 acres of agricultural land. Throughout the war, the nearby Blickling Hall was used to house the officers and airmen, where a museum now stands with a collection of objects and documents donated by families whose relatives served there. The airfield was closed for operations in 1946 and finally decommissioned in 1949. In 2015, plans for a solar farm on part of the site, west of the proposed AD plant, were approved with the understanding it would run for 25 years. But in 2024, Broadland Council approved an amendment to the plans, which allows the solar farm to remain in operation until 2065.
A bed and breakfast in North Norfolk is appearing on a hit television show this week. Holly Lodge in Thursford is featuring on Channel 4's Four in a Bed, which sees B&B owners stay and rate each other's properties. The 18th century guest house has been part of the Thursford site since 2019 and will be the focus of the week-long competition. Elizabeth Goode, Bookings and Reservations Manager at Holly Lodge, who appears alongside manager Barbara Cushing, said being asked to appear on Channel 4's Four in a Bed has been both a daunting and an amazing experience. It has allowed us to showcase our beautiful bed and breakfast to a wider audience, but also enabled us to learn from others in the hospitality industry. The duo filmed over 2 weeks in April 2025, visiting and staying at competing B&Bs across the country. When Four in a Bed called, we jumped at the opportunity, Mrs. Cushing said. It's been a real treat to travel the country and experience others' bed and breakfasts, and a privilege to welcome the other competitors here to Thursford. You'll have to watch the series to see how we've done. It's a special set of episodes in this long-lasting successful show. Holly Lodge has secured a 5-star rating from the AA for 2 consecutive years and is a finalist in the 2026 Suffolk and Norfolk Tourism Awards in the Guest House and B&B of the Year category. The property offers 6 guest rooms, including a bridal suite, alongside 3 cottages and a shepherd's hut. Four in a Bed has aired more than 1,000 episodes since its first launch in 2010.
A former railway station along a popular walking route is set for a new lease of life more than 60 years after it closed. It is now full steam ahead for plans to convert the vacant Felmingham station building on the Weavers Way path after they were given the green light by North Norfolk District Council. Under the proposal submitted by the owner of the site, Darren Hall, the building containing the former ticket office and booking hall will be transformed into a one-bedroom home. The council's planning officer said the bid proposed a sensitive conversion of this non-designated heritage asset, helping to secure its sustainable long-term future. Mr. Hall, who purchased the property at auction from Norfolk County Council, submitted the plans to convert the building in 2022. In a statement, it said that only a limited number of the original station buildings remain in existence on the North Walsham to Aylsham line, with buildings such as Aylsham North and South demolished after closure. Therefore, it argued that the bid would secure the future of the building and would allow the important heritage asset to be preserved. Also, it added that its use as a private residence will protect it from antisocial behaviour and vandalism, which was always a risk in this remote location. Felmingham Station, which is between North Walsham and Aylsham, opened in 1883. And was on the Midland and Great Northern Joint Railway. During its operational years, the station facilitated both local passenger and goods traffic, including agricultural produce. But in 1959, the line closed, and since then, the building has lain vacant, apart from opening for occasional heritage visit. The disused railway line now forms part of the 61-mile-long Weavers Way footpath and cycleway, linking Cromer to Great Yarmouth.
Somebody in Norfolk won a whopping £1 million in this month's Premium Bond Prize draw. But they were not the only locals to get lucky in March. A total of 369 people across the county scooped a share of 1,919,000, averaging £5,214 each. Of these, the second biggest winner was somebody in Norwich who bagged an impressive £50,000. 9 people won £25,000, 15 people won £10,000, and 38 people won £5,000. Hundreds more received £1,000.
Langham Dome Museum has appealed for volunteers. The Heritage Museum is seeking individuals who can donate a few hours each month to engage with the museum's visitors. Applicants only need to have a friendly disposition, and be able to communicate with the public. Interested parties are encouraged to contact Scott either by phoning 07833 09588 or by emailing manager@langhamdome, all one word, .org.
A popular car boot sale is returning for the 2026 season this weekend. The organisers of the Late One sale in Aylsham have revealed it will be back on Saturday, March the 7th. The event runs from a field at the A140 junction with Bure Road opposite the BP garage every Saturday and bank holiday Monday from spring until autumn. The last event of 2025 was cancelled due to the wet weather, so it has been a particularly long wait for bargain hunters. "We're back and ready for a brand new season," the organisers said in their return announcement. "It's been a long wait and we are so excited to see everyone again. Let's make this season the best one yet." Sellers will be welcome from 7 a.m. and buyers can come along from 11 a.m. A single pitch costs £8, while a double pitch and a trailer costs £13. Dogs are not permitted and there are refreshments and toilets on site.
One of Norfolk's best-known landmarks is hiring for a staff member who would have the rare opportunity to live inside an 18th-century mansion. Holcombe Hall is searching for a live-in housekeeper to ensure the site is safe and secure around the clock. The role would see the successful candidate live in a one-bed flat inside the hall itself, a Palladian mansion famed for its grand architecture, opulent interiors and extensive art collections. Recruiting firm Larstone is advertising the job on behalf of the estate. A spokesman said, "We are so excited to be recruiting for a live-in house person at a stunning Norfolk estate. This is a rare and rewarding opportunity to join a prestigious team, support daily estate operations, assist with maintenance and security, and play a key part in keeping one of Norfolk's most iconic homes running smoothly. You will be based on site, with accommodation included, enjoy variety in your day-to-day work with a supportive team, and be part of something truly special. Candidates can apply via Larstone Recruitment website."
Our last few articles cover Old Time Music Hall at Sheringham Little Theatre, big plans for the 60th Worsted Festival, a new eating experience at Wiverton Hall, and a top award for a brave Coast Guard.
A classic variety show is bringing the sounds and spirit of Old Time Music Hall back to the stage. A Victorian Edwardian-style production from the Don't Dilly Dally Company, featuring comedy, song and speciality acts, will be performed at Sheringham Little Theatre on March the 27th and 28th. Leading the show as chairman is Richard Gauntlett, a familiar face from the Cromer Pier Summer Show, and a long-serving dame, writer and director of the Norwich Theatre Royal Pantomime. Mr. Gauntlett said, "We're putting new life into Old Time Music Hall. Our reincarnation has all the hallmarks of a period variety show with good singers and comedy, which made it so popular on the stage and on TV in the good old days, which ran for 30 years from 1953 to 1983. The audiences have great fun and go away still singing the sing-along songs. They love to dress up for the occasion and there will be a prize for the best dressed person," he said. The cast features seasoned entertainers from the West End and beyond, including Jay Alexander, Georgina Jackson, Isabella Mason, Ben Stock and Kane Verrill. Despite his strong connection to the Norfolk theatre scene, this will be Mr. Gauntlett's first time performing at Sheringham Little Theatre. he described the venue as an intimate venue right in the heart of the town and said he was looking forward to the show. Mr. Gauntlet's career has spanned theatre, television and live variety, including West End roles in The Lion King and Beauty and the Beast, appearances in Gilbert and Sullivan operas, a part as Urach in Doctor Who, and writing for The Sooty Show. As chairman, he will introduce acts in traditional alliterative music hall style and lead the audience through the show's sing-along moments. Performances take place on Friday, March the 27th at 7:30 p.m. and Saturday, March the 28th at 2:30 p.m. and 7:30 p.m. Tickets from sheringhamlittletheatre.com or the box office on 01263 822 347. Costumes can be hired from North Norfolk Theatre Wardrobe at northnorfolktheatrewardrobe.co.uk.
More than 10,000 people are expected to descend on Worstead as the village prepares for the 60th anniversary of its popular festival. Planning is already underway for the event, which has been held on the last weekend in July ever since its first outing in 1966. The big weekend falls on July the 25th and 26th this year, when the usual village population is set to swell to 10 times its normal size. Entertainment lined up includes galloping horses, BMX stunt riders, dog agility, live music, a chef theatre, fairground rides, and BrickCon for Lego fans. There will also be more than 100 artisan craft stalls and a wide array of food concessions, as well as a well-stocked bar. The 14th century church will host the Flower Festival, singers, weavers and a cafe. Festival chair, Jane Bond, praised the volunteers at the recent AGM following last year's event. "I am delighted to share that we were able to distribute £35,000 to local charities and clubs," she said. "This is a tremendous achievement and a testament to the community spirit that defines the festival, and one I am so proud to be involved in." Saturday will feature vintage tractors and classic cars on display, as well as heavy horses, which have their own show ring and will parade in the main ring on Sunday. Music lovers can look forward to a headline set from Agent Orange on Saturday night. Other activities include the Westover Dog Show, bouncy castles, a petting farm, and a children's craft tent. The festival kicks off on Friday evening with the Worstead 5 Mile Run and opens to the public at 10 a.m. on Saturday with music from the City of Norwich Pipe Band. Entry prices are £10 per day or £15 for the weekend, with free entry for children under 16 if accompanied by an adult.
A new foodie destination, complete with a bar, a range of independent traders and views over the North Norfolk coast, is launching for the first time this year. The team behind Mysa Bar and Mysa Garden has collaborated with Wiverton Hall to bring a six-week dining hotspot to the venue near Clay. Plans include a stretch tent, a craft beer bar, and a changing lineup of independent food traders offering seafood, tacos and street food. Confirmed vendors include Randy's Seafood, tacos from The Cabin, Indian street food from Namaste, and wings from Just Wingin' It. Spanish delights from Churros and Chorizo will also be included, as will soul food from The Soul Kitchen, chicken burgers from Hen House, bayo buns from Moco Kitchen, ice cream from Feel Good Ice Cream, fried chicken from Bubba, and poke bowls from Pokenom. The idea is to create a truly unique place for families and friends to gather, enjoy good food and drinks while soaking in the incredible views, explained Chris Howard, part of the team behind Mysabar. The company has previously hosted pop-up events in Castle Gardens in Norwich, Salhouse Broad and Chapelfield Gardens. The Wiverton Hall pop-up will be family-friendly, with children's activities and quiet seating, along with music from Wildpaths Music Festival and a roster of DJs. Seth McClott, also of the Mysabar team, said, "We wanted to develop Mysabar this year, and when we were asked to consider Wiverton Hall with its beautiful marsh view over to Clay Beach, it didn't take us long to conjure up the destination venue that we had planned. We have some incredible food vendors on board and plenty of events in the making that we cannot wait to share over the coming months." Desmond McCarthy, owner of Wiverton Hall, added, "I hope lots of people will come and enjoy our wonderful destination with its special views." Mysabar at Wiverton Hall will run from Wednesday, July the 22nd to Sunday, August the 30th.
A brave Coast Guard who helped save the life of a woman trapped against rocks off the Norfolk coast has been honoured with a top award. On September the 16th, HM Coast Guard received a 999 call reporting that a group of swimmers were trapped against a rock groin off the Sheringham coast. Sheringham and Cromer Coast Rescue Teams, CRT, and Munsley Volunteer Inshore Lifeboat rushed to the scene, where a woman was stuck in a perilous position as 50-mile-an-hour winds pounded the shore. With the lifeboat still on its way, the decision was made to carry out a team tethered rescue. Gareth Davis, Sheringham Coast Guard Rescue Officer, CRO, was sent out to recover the swimmer while securely attached to a line held by his teammates on the shore. Mr. Davis was able to make his way out to the stranded woman and assisted her away from the heaving sea and back to safety. Once on shore, the woman was treated for serious lacerations to her arms and legs and hypothermia before being handed into the care of East of England Ambulance Service. The other three swimmers had already managed to get themselves to safety. Now, Mr. Davis has been awarded the Chief Coast Guard Commendation, one of the highest accolades in HM Coast Guard. Assistant Chief Coast Guard John Craig said, "The casualty had been pushed up against rock armour by wind and tide and desperately needed the timely intervention of Coast Guard rescue officers. The extrication of the casualty in difficult conditions, medical care afterwards and management of the scene were in the very best traditions of HM Coast Guard's expertise and dedication. There can be no doubt that the teamwork involved on that morning led to the saving of a life." Letters of appreciation also went to Sheringham CROs, Alison Marriott, Steve Price, Emma Wright and Caroline Clark, and Cromer CROs Nathan Jonas, Jackie James, Harriet Barnard, Steve Lane, Will Witham and Jim Lilly.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler, with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, you can contact our listener liaison officer, Imogen Waterson, on 01263 587 610.
Perhaps we should just mention that if you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker, a variety of smartphone apps, or even a telephone call to listen. Find out the details on our website, mardler.org.uk.
We rely on receiving your returned memory sticks and pouches so that we can continue to send you new editions each week. So please remember to return the pouch and memory stick promptly, making sure to reverse the address label first.
The sound engineer today was Richard Wilson. Editing and producing this issue were Chris and Lorna Wilson. But do keep listening, as immediately following this edition of The Mardler, you can hear items from the Talking News Federation. Our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in wishing you the best of health, and we look forward to joining you again in a week's time. But for now, it's
cheerio!
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello, this is Alastair Hutton with an article from Heather. Training is underway for one of the largest litters of puppies welcomed by the charity Guide Dogs. Doggy mum Yori, a golden retriever cross, gave birth to a huge litter of 13 puppies at the end of last summer. A normal litter size averages around 7 or 8 pups. The litter has been nicknamed the Baker's Dozen, reflecting the common historical practice of bakers in rounding up a dozen loaves to 13. It's generally thought the bakers adopted this practice to make sure they didn't fall foul of strict laws that linked the price of their wares to minimum weights. In keeping with the Baker's Dozen nickname, all 13 puppies have been given bakery-themed names. The 6 girls have been called Apple, Eccles, Coco, Chelsea, Custard and Ginger. Meanwhile, the 7 boys have been named Biscuit, Crumble, Bagel, Crumpet, Pretzel, Rye and Tiger. Because of the size of the litter, it was felt that Mum Yori might struggle to look after all 13 puppies. With this in mind, for their first 8 weeks, 10 puppies stayed with Yori, while 3 were fostered by another guide dog with a smaller litter born at the same time. At 8 weeks old, the full litter of 13 was reunited at Guide Dogs National Centre near Leamington Spa. Now embarking on the next step towards becoming guide dogs, each of the Baker's Dozen has a new temporary home with one of the guide dogs' volunteer puppy raisers around the UK. They'll stay with their puppy raisers until they're old enough to join the formal guide dog training programme. If all 13 make the grade, they should be on track to become fully fledged guide dogs next year in 2027. Every year, around 1,350 puppies start their journey to become a guide dog, but it is an expensive business as it now costs £77,000 to breed, puppy raise and train each guide dog.
Hello, I am Lindsay, and welcome to discovering a little about handy musical hobbies. Handbells are probably one of the most accessible and basic of musical instruments. Fortunately, Sue, the leader of a visually impaired handbell ringing team in Stockport, Greater Manchester, UK, kindly agreed to a telephone conversation to literally describe the ups and downs of playing. Wallthew House in Stockport is a centre serving the visually impaired and the deaf community. The building itself was left to the charity and is still run by volunteers today for various activities, one of which is handbell ringing. Sue got involved unexpectedly with leading the Stockport visually impaired handbell ringing team over 20 years ago when out performing with her sighted team.
I was actually playing with a sighted team, and we were playing in a garden centre, and this staff came over and just said that they found a set of handbells in Wallthew House, and would anybody be interested in starting up a team?
She explains here what type of handbells the teams play and why their ringing technique is different.
Well, you could have any number of pieces. I mean, at the moment, we've got five. There's two methods of ringing sand bells. You can ring in hand, where you actually hold them, and you can either have two bells, or a lot of people play four bells, two bells in each hand. The blind do, because obviously it's more difficult for them. My other tip, we play off the table. So all the bells are on the table, and we just pick them up and ring them when the note that's required. That's how you've got different sorts of hand bells. You've got American bells and English bells.
What's the difference between the two, then?
English bells are more traditional. They have leather handles, and the clappers, which actually strike bells, either leather, plastic, or like a felt, depending on the size of the bell. The American bells are plastic. They have white handles for, like, the white notes on a piano, and they have black handles for the black notes on a piano, and their clappers are plastic, which you can turn.
Are they all cast bells? Are they heavy?
No, not the ones that we play normal hand bells. You can get some that are very big. I mean, it's like swinging around two bags of sugar. So they are heavy, but we don't use the big bells for the blind.
I understand there's 3 octave and 5 octave. Is that...
Try 5 octaves, or you can anything in between.
There has to be a more vocal approach to learning musical arrangements for the visually impaired handbell ringers, although even sighted players learn to use a simple word search style chart indicating number or note specific handbells, including rhythm sequences, in order to play a tune, unlike traditional score written music. Here Sue again explains method adaptions and the helpfulness of choosing team familiar tunes and songs.
Blind have to learn by a little bit at a time, and you don't have such complicated, you would only play 2-3 notes at a time. They can't see when you come in. You can't have a conductor. So everything is done by just learning. We do quite a lot of well-known songs, classical music, old songs, modern songs. And I tend to try and get pieces that they know. That's how they do it. And then gradually they learn, and then they know when they're coming in.
I know a lot of handbell teams probably have audiences. I know one in Essex which actually allows some of the audience members to come up who are visually impaired and have a go at ringing the bells. But I think you are very much unique in the fact that you have a whole team.
Although informal UK mini, regional and national rallies take place, there are more formal events where handbell ringers can tackle complex and larger range music compositions, like regional orchestras or the International Symposium, held in different countries every 2 years. Whatever size event, it is an opportunity for the handbell ringers to showcase their skills and share in performing music together. It seems this unique handbell ringing team really enjoy the social aspect of joining in mixed ability handbell rallies.
Do you get to competition standard? No, this is all just for enjoyment and fun.
Yes, we tend to just join up together every so often in areas and have an enjoyable day all ringing together. The blind team have joined in with a pick. You play a solo bit, which they've done. And then they join it. We have a mass ring. What we did, because at that particular time, there were only a few of them, the three of us, and they came and joined in our sighted tune. And they knew the tune because we had done it. And so they just joined in, and, you know, we would say, D, B, D, D. They just joined in.
The Stockport Handbell Ringers team themselves must get an awful lot of sense of achievement from learning, like you say, maybe a fairly complicated piece, but actually because they know the familiar song, it makes it easier for them to get the essence of it.
I would think so. I mean, they seem to enjoy it and they come up each week.
When asking about handbell ringing benefits, it became clear that achievement of mastering songs was not the only uplifting experience for the Stockport team, but also for the wider community. Sue recounts some of these occasions.
We have played for WI, we've played for, well, other groups within the Wolfhew House, played for a nursery, and at one Christmas, and did lots of carols with them. So, yes, they have, but it's more we meet each week, and they enjoy it.
Thank you, Sue, for being my special guest.
If interested further in handbell ringing, you can contact the charity Handbell Ringers of Great Britain, HRGB, on their website, www.handbells.org.uk. Clean Sweep Brain Teaser at the Weather Station. Welcome to Lindsay's Ear Spy activity for yourself or with others. Listen carefully to this one-sided imaginary telephone conversation and find out how many weather conditions you can recognise along the way. The correct number will be announced at the end. There's fog here this morning, hero. Even heard the ship's horn sounding from the coast. Well, the station is built on the mountain, so it can get all four seasons in one day. Quite a trek, but then Sue Nami, the lead researcher, did warn me beforehand. Friendly bunch. That's right, trying to recruit next generation. They held some kind of school's experience day to encourage careers in meteorology. In fact, I've just discovered the experience feedback box file by the door. Oh, they're all taking measurement readings outside. Won't mind. Besides, perks of the job is looking through the comments. Listen to this one. Did you find the day informative? Thought the whole hurricane, typhoon and cyclone bit was gonna explain the difference between them, but seems all mean the same. Only start forming in different parts of the world. Overcomplicated, should stick with one name, Rani. I suppose, hero, you're in a constant heat wave over there. Unbearable at times. And then frost at night. Surprised you knew what clothes to pack for your desert archaeological dig. Drizzle when you left London Airport. Bet you miss it now. Talking of flying, what did you find most interesting? The special aircraft which chase a tornado. Be awesome to be one of those pilots. Mac. Yeah, clearly they missed the point of the day. It wasn't supposed to be about aviation careers. Of course, this lot are very reliant on sensitive instruments to predict everything at any time in the UK. Your local guides are able to predict a sudden sandstorm or thunderstorm with uncanny accuracy on the ground and without any need for GPS or a technology app. Just as well, hero, safety first. Why, I never fancied your profession. Too much time outdoors and too much heavy-duty cleaning. Although this little ray of sunshine doesn't seem to mind the thought of any adverse conditions. Which part of the world would you want to monitor weather? Arctic, definitely. Getting to play in the snow would be brilliant, and checking on the wildlife after a blizzard be awesome collecting life-saving data, plus using real cutting-edge science stuff. Juna. Oh, nothing as dramatic on the mountain today. Not even sleet. Just some rain sweeping in. Well, I must finish cataloguing too. Put these forms back in the right order. Take care, hero. Bye for now. Did you recognise the weather conditions mentioned? Total count was 16. Naval Officer Vice Admiral Robert Fitzroy was not only the person who established the first UK Met Office in 1854, but also the originator of the Storm Warning Service in 1861, which relied on a network of 15 land stations telegraphing their current data from across the nation. To expand this warning service, in 1922, the first shipping forecast was broadcast by radio. Here is the full list of answers, read out in the order they were originally spoken. Fog, tsunami, hurricane, typhoon, cyclone, heat wave, frost, drizzle, tornado, sandstorm, thunderstorm, sunshine, snow, blizzard, sleet, rain. If you did catch all 16 of them, well done. And if you missed a few, hope you still enjoyed the challenge.
TNF Soundings.